Okay, sorry about that. Some mic issues. Great. Okay, fantastic. Okay, I know, perfect timing. I guess I wasn't supposed to start until 8 o'clock. It must be karma, and we'll be talking about this tonight. So yeah, tonight on our time together, the Bhagavad Gita we are at the minute, we're going to be looking at the concepts of reincarnation and karma. Lots of interesting things to talk about this evening. But before we start, we're just going to offer our consecration so that we net our karma out. So we're offering up all karma. We don't even want the good karma. And that's our consecration. It's also a reminder to us that our time together is sacred. And not just this time together, but the whole of our lives are sacred. So whenever we make a consecration, we're just reminding ourselves of the sacredness of every moment, and also sort of putting ourselves in a place of service. So sort of offering that our time spent together today is for the benefit of all. So to do that, we're just gonna take a moment just to settle down. So maybe that's relaxing the shoulders, or just settling into the chair or wherever you happen to be, and feeling yourself sort of rooting down through the feet, through the base of the spine. And then just your awareness. So just observing from this place of comfort. Just observing the breath, and maybe that's in the nostrils, or maybe it's in the belly. So we're just beginning to give the mind something to focus on, to take us sort of back into our body and away from the wandering thoughts. And just noticing if we can relax a little bit more. Finding some space between the shoulders so that the chest can open and soften. And from this sort of openness in the center of our chest, our heart center, our Anahata chakra, I'm just going to make an offering of our time together. So whatever words have meaning to you, feel free to use those. Just offering all the karmic fruits to the benefit of all, sending them back, and asking that all beings be blessed from our time together, recognizing our time. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. And then we'll just take a deep breath together and exhaling it out. Okay, great. So yeah, today it's sort of a challenging topic, reincarnation, but it's a very fundamental part of the Bhagavad Gita, as mentioned throughout, and indeed is mentioned right at the beginning. So if you remember where we are, and we've talked about several of the themes now that have been in the Gita, Bhakti Yoga and Jnana Yoga, the Yoga of Wisdom, Karma Yoga, but it all takes place on this battlefield of Kurukshetra. And Arjuna, who is sort of prepared for this battle against all of his relatives, and fulfilling his dharma, is kind of like bottles it just at the beginning and has all these doubts. And Krishna, who's next to him, begins his teaching. But right in the very beginning, when Arjuna stops and then allows Krishna to speak, it's right then and there that Krishna talks about reincarnation. So when Arjuna sat there and is thinking about how they're all going to be killed and just how awful that is, it's here that Krishna sort of says, you know, you need to stop identifying with the body and ego, because there's a whole lot more going on that you don't know about. And I'm just going to read a couple of things that he mentions there in chapter 2, just so you can get a sense of what we're going to be talking about. Okay. So he says, you are grieving, Arjuna, you are grieving for those who should not be grieved for, while uttering would-be words of wisdom. The wise grieve neither for the living nor the dead. There was never a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor any of these ruling princes that Arjuna's looking at. And neither will there ever come a time when we cease to be. So he's beginning to let him know that if he has this battle, no one really gets killed because there's something else going on. And he says, that which is embodied experiences the body's childhood, youth, and old age, and also in time acquires another body. This does not disturb one whose mind is calm. So, I mean, the whole goal of yoga is to be incredibly calm, is to let go of all the thoughts and have a completely calm mind. And when you reach this place, as Krishna sort of goes into a lot of detail throughout the Gita of how to get there, then you are sort of understand that there is no birth and there is no death. And he goes on here, and this is a very famous verse within the Gita, and this is Sloka 20. It is not born and it does not die. Unborn, eternal, and ancient, the self is not killed when the body is killed. Right off the bat, we're talking about reincarnation, or at least he's giving the clues that something is beyond what Arjuna is identifying with right now on the battlefield. And this is, remember, with the Gita, it's reflective not just of this battle, but it's supposed to be our daily lives or what's going on with our body and mind. And we can kind of see that a lot of times we get very caught up in what's happening in the moment and our emotions and how the body is feeling. It also almost sort of helps to then have this new perspective come in, that sort of voice inside us say, you know, I understand you're very caught up in what's happening, but you're missing the larger picture here. There's something so much more, and really that's what you're here to learn. You're here to learn what that is. So reincarnation, for those of us in the West, is pretty hard to grasp. And even when we can say, well, you know, I've read a bit about reincarnation and I believe in reincarnation, you know, really, what does that mean? For some of us, perhaps there is a knowing about reincarnation, and we'll talk in a bit about whether reincarnation is even true or not, and does it even matter if we believe in it or not. But sort of just based on the Gita and the teachings of the Gita, which are sort of a fundamental part of it, is that you will reincarnate. You know, what does that mean for us? I mean, how do we get our heads around it? So Ram Dass talks a little bit about this in his book, Path of Living the Bhagavad Gita. And he basically, you are, you know, maybe doing some past life regression or in meditation, you have some clues, or maybe you just have this feeling that you've been some places before, or that you may have studied some certain things before, and that some people are familiar to you. And the other way is, of course, if someone learned who you respect and trust, like a guru perhaps, tells you about your past lives, or just says that reincarnation is true. And in fact, Ram Dass says for him, this was, you know, his Maharaji, his guru said, this is the way it is. And he never doubted Maharaji. And so reincarnation is the way it is for Ram Dass. And we hear all different stories that maybe make us think that reincarnation is true. You know, children have personalities very early on, for example, that you can't quite marry up with their genetics. And we think about where is that from? And then we look at people like, you know, the lives of Mozart, perhaps. Where he's sort of a child genius, creates sonatas at the age of 4 and is giving public recitals at 5 and composing his first opera at 7. And you think, well, did he really learn all that in such a short time? Or could it be possible that in a past life, He had all that experience and then just brought that over with him. So there are sort of, you know, fun things to think about as Westerners regarding reincarnation. And it's certainly always on our radar, and as spiritual seekers, we've probably thought about it. Excuse me. But it's very much a part of Eastern wisdom. So you'll find reincarnation in Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, Sikhism, and actually Islam is one death. But there are certain quotes even to be found from Muhammad that do point to reincarnation. I'm just pulling a couple up now. Let's have a look. So yeah, in the Quran, there's a couple of verses. Let's see. God is the one who created you all, then provided you sustenance, then will cause you to die, and then will bring you back to life. It is God who brings the dead from the living. And I tell you of a truth that the spirits now have an affinity that shall be kindred together, although they will meet in new persons with new names. So that's in the Quran. And then similarly, Ram Dass points out that even in the Bible, it points to reincarnation. And I'm just going to pull that up. Here we go. So he says, if you notice, Christ says that John the Baptist was Elijah previously. And the wisdom of Solomon says to be born in sound body with sound limbs is a reward of the virtues of past lives. And the disciples asked Christ, was this man born blind because of something he did previously or because of his parents? So, and Ram Dass sort of supposes that those beliefs kind of were hotly debated about reincarnation, and it was decided that the church couldn't really control everyone if they thought they were going to come back and have another chance. So far better to let them think they're going to have an eternity of hellfire and brimstone and get rid of the idea of reincarnation. But that's just his take on it. But there are also some sort of lovely quotes through the ages about reincarnation. For example, Rumi, the Persian mystic, says, I died as stone and rose again as plant. I died as plant and became an animal. I died as animal and was born a man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more shall I die as man to soar with the angels. But even from angelhood I must then pass on, for all is change except the face of God. So, yeah, as I said, you know, for the West, it's a little bit of a strange concept, but the mystics, certainly, reincarnation is grounded within those traditions. And there are all sorts of different models and teachings about reincarnation and what it looks like. So, for example, as we just heard from Rumi's belief in reincarnation is that we sort of move up some sort of hierarchical structure, or you could call it, if you, you know, as I believe, that we're actually all level. Rather, we move across planes of consciousness from plant to animal to person to something else, and then make our way all the way up and maybe come back down at points. So some people say that you only ever move upwards. So maybe you have several reincarnations or several incarnations as a plant, and then many as a bird, and then an animal, and many, many, many as a human. But ultimately, you're only moving up the planes of consciousness, or the planes of awakening. And others will say that you get to pick and choose, that maybe you were a high being at some point that felt they had to come back to Earth for a lesson, so back you pop as a human. Some teachings will say that, you know, you can, it's just luck of the draw. Maybe I know one of my Buddhist friends says it's very urgent to become enlightened in this life, because in your next you could be an ant, and then you don't have a chance of awakening as an ant because you don't have the capacity. And then you could have many, many, many lifetimes as various ants and beetles before you finally make it back. So many different teachings out there. Let's have another one here. So the Buddha, for example, talks about there are no real ego entities, moving through the ocean of rebirth, just waves. So that's another way of looking at it, that there are just sort of these waves that manifest here and there, back and forth. The Gita says that there are, that you do move upwards, and based on your karma, you could move downwards. So based on your actions will depend on how you incarnate. But ultimately, if you're a spiritual seeker on a path, you will always make progress in every incarnation. And we're going to talk a bit about that later. So there's lots of different teachings of reincarnation. One of my favorites is this from the Buddha. So how long is long when we're talking about reincarnation? And here is an image from the Southern Buddhist literature that gives us an idea of the kind of time spans we're talking about in, when we're sort of contemplating how many lives we may have lived. The Buddha was trying to describe the length of time we've been playing this game of reincarnating. He said, imagine a mountain 1 mile wide. Every 100 years, a bird flies by with a silk scarf. In time it would take for the silk scarf to wear away that entire mountain is what we call a kalpa. That's K-A-L-P-A. I'll just type that in. So the time it would take for a silk scarf to wear away at that mountain, to wear it completely down, is called a kalpa. And we have been playing this game of reincarnation for kalpa upon kalpa upon kalpa. So it's so mind-blowing when you start to think about reincarnation and how many lives and how many existences we've had, that you can sort of get a bit frazzled by it, which is a great place to be in as you're starting to meditate. Your mind is blown. And I often think about the universe and how we can't get our head around it, and that we, you know, we are, it's enough to think we're this solar system, and then we realize actually we're one of many solar systems within a galaxy, and then we realize that there are billions and billions and billions of galaxies, and it goes on and on and on, and all of a sudden you just sort of think, oh my goodness, it doesn't even matter that I don't understand. So so when we're thinking about the lives we've had and the people we've interacted with, in the end, we just, you can kind of, how I think of it is, if time doesn't exist, then we kind of are everyone and everything. Everything we look at, every person we interact with, we've been everything. We've had every experience possible. However, why do we keep reincarnating? I'm going to get to that a bit later. So is it so crazy to think about reincarnation? Obviously, when we think about in terms of these kalpas that we've had been going on forever, and actually yoga kind of suggests that there was never a time when we weren't reincarnating. There wasn't this beginning process. It's always been happening, which is sort of blows the mind even further. But is it so crazy to think about reincarnation? And sometimes I like to think it's a bit easier to get your head around if you think about this just one life. So how many of you remember your own birth? I'm guessing none of you perhaps remember, maybe one of you. Traumatic memory, I'm sure, but if you do have that, so I'm not sure if I wish that on you, but most of us don't remember our own birth. And yet we know we were born. And of course, you know, who we were as a 5-year-old version of us is completely different to who we are now, or is completely different to who we are as a 10-year-old version and a 15-year-old version and 20-year-old version. And even who we are yesterday is completely different to who we are today. So you can actually think of reincarnation in terms of you're living and dying in every moment, or always, always changing. You are becoming someone entirely different. But with you, you're bringing along certain tendencies that you've learned that you haven't quite let go. And this is really the essence of reincarnation, that we have these tendencies that we take from life to life to life until eventually we get rid of them. So I'm just going to read verse 13 again, because I think this is really what it's talking about in chapter 2. So that which is embodied experiences, the body's childhood, youth, and old age, and also in time acquires another body. So it's really saying that, you know, you're experiencing childhood and youth and old age. And those themselves are sort of reincarnations of yourself. And this does not disturb one whose mind is calm. So obviously for us, we were more trained. Our mind is calm when thinking of aging. We're not thinking of it as just many, many reincarnations within one lifetime. But it's an interesting way to think of it. Is it really so crazy, reincarnation? So, I mean, why does it even serve us to even think about reincarnation? Which I think is a good point for us Westerners, because you can get caught up. It's very heady, reincarnation. And last week we were looking at Jnana Yoga and the yoga of knowledge and comparing that knowledge to wisdom. And I know a lot of people sort of fall down this rabbit hole of getting very excited about exploring all of their past lives to try and help them explain who they are today. Or they have a real passion for reading many books about the afterlife and where the soul's journey goes and where it comes back. And I know that there was a time I was sort of in my teens, I was really fascinated with that. But eventually it slows you down and you kind of have to let go of this concept of reincarnation, because how can we ever understand it? I know it's all sort of conjecture. But where it does serve us, in my mind, is that it begins to open us up to this idea that there's something beyond the human experience that we're having. So for Arjuna, obviously Krishna is opening him up to say, you know, there is something much more happening here. And I feel like just even contemplating reincarnation can do that for us. And I'm sure it's something that many of us here tonight have thought about. So sort of the way I see it going is, you know, you start to think, okay, well, if reincarnation is true, then what is it that's coming back life after life? That would probably be the first question you ask yourself. What is that? Is it like an essence? Is it your personality? Is your ego? So you're beginning to explore, is there a separate part of me, a part that could be eternal? And then maybe you start to think, well, okay, well, why would this part of me come back? And then the sort of logical conclusion would be, well, it's, you know, it's either looking for new experiences, or perhaps it has some loose ends it wants to tie up, perhaps it enjoys it. And then you start to think, okay, but is life really that enjoyable? And hopefully most of us will say yes, it is, but we know for many, many people it's not. There is a lot of suffering. And then if you think about reincarnation, then you're kind of aware that yourself must have experienced some very bad lives at some point. And okay, you're having a good one right now, but would anything that's intelligent want to come back and take that gamble? So you can start to sort of see that maybe some inner wisdom starts to come through about this sort of separate part of yourself that it is ongoing, and the process of reincarnation, just by sort of beginning to contemplate it, some wisdom or inner wisdom starts to come through. And there are many explanations as to, you know, why your soul comes back, and we can talk a bit more about that. But above all, I think it's important to just sort of bear this in mind, that it is still an illusion, reincarnation. I know that when I was studying with Regina for my ministry, we looked at reincarnation as a relative truth. It's not absolute truth. So the way I've talked about it before is that there's this crystal ball, and that everything is happening in. And in yoga, it's called Prakriti. It's the manifest. And manifest can be very gross, like our bodies, and it can also be very subtle, like thoughts and emotions are also within this crystal ball. And the whole reincarnation and that part of us that reincarnates, all of that is still within this crystal ball. And then the truth and the oneness, or the unmanifest, or the Brahman, is outside of the crystal ball. So I know that we can, especially I hear it from yoga students, you can start to talk like reincarnation is the truth. And the same with the chakra system. People will say, no, this is the way it is, and prana is the way, you know, it's the truth. But it's still all within this crystal ball. Excuse me. I'm thirsty tonight. Sorry about that. So as we're talking through this, I think it's just helpful to remember that we're really looking at reincarnation as, okay, this concept, how can it serve us on our spiritual journey? Just to even engage with this idea, what is it about? How does it help us? And why do the Buddhists talk about it and Hindus talk about it and enlightened masters and sages teach it? So at some point also, you know, as I mentioned, the line of questioning is, okay, so if reincarnation is true, there's this part of me that keeps coming back, but why does it keep coming back? And then we also start to ask, what's beyond that? What is it that's causing us to come back? So this is like a natural line of inquiry that can lead us to truth once we start to contemplate reincarnation. So in Hinduism, there is this explanation for what happens that I'm going to share with you. And it's pretty logical. It says that our thinking patterns in our lives, as we experience them, lead to actions. In other words, we act and the karma is sort of living out because our minds tell us to. Because that is how we satisfy our desires, and they are called vasanas. Let me type that in. Vasanas, V-A-S-A-N-A-S, vasanas. And those arise from impressions called samskaras, which you may have all heard of, made in the mind from an earlier action. So there's this path. And it's said that when we die, there's samskaras, there's impressions in our lives, and the vasanas of the desires we take with us to our next life. And that will cause the karma in our next life. So our thoughts will come from this past actions, from this past vasanas, and our karma in this life is sort of driven by that. So it's this whole big cycle. And so I'm just going to talk about the vasanas for a moment because they're an important part of the Hindu teachings. Let's have a look. So they're like waves, as Buddha mentioned earlier, the vasanas have got to be seen as waves, and they're very subtle thought forms. So every act we do will create these vasanas, these waves, and they're almost like the desires. And those life waves go out and out and out, and even when we die, they continue, and the physical body dies, but what remains are those subtle life waves, sort of mental tendencies. They're almost like a DNA code which determine your next round here. And then that's called karma. And karma is basically this pattern of waves that keeps going and going, life after life, until they spend themselves. And essentially, it's based on desire. So for as long as we have desires, we will keep coming back. And that's what the Gita teaches. So, and I fall into this trap a lot, and I don't know if you do, but I might say, well, in my next life, I'd really like to be rich. And then I sort of try and think, oh, no, because I don't want to keep coming back. That's not what the path of a yogi is. You're supposed to sort of net out all your karma so you don't ever have to come back into this cycle. Or I know some people say, oh, in my next life, I'd love to be a botanist or work in a zoo. And it's said that these desires that sort of remain in us are the ones that cause us to come back. And you'll notice, and Swami Sachidananda points this out in the Gita, that for people who you might have met who seem very far along on their path, you'll notice that they aren't seeking fulfillment in the material world. So maybe they choose to be a monk, perhaps. You know, they're not like, oh, if only I could visit another country, or I really want to, you know, have a large family. Like, they've done all those things, as Swami Sachidananda. They've exhausted all those possibilities. We can't even imagine how many lifetimes they've lived, but they've actually done everything. And now they've got to the point where they really have no more desires other than to awaken. So I think it's a good excuse for going and doing everything you possibly can now in this lifetime, living like you only live once, just so that all your desires are exhausted. Okay. So, and Paramahamsa Yogananda sort of talks about the soul and what that is, because I think that can be a confusing concept, because sometimes we talk about the soul reincarnating and we think, okay, well, maybe these vasanas and these desires and the likes and dislikes that come with it, and that's the soul. In which case, what is the difference between the soul and the spirit? And Paramahamsa Yogananda shares this quite beautifully, I think. So he says, the difference between the soul and the spirit is this. The spirit is ever existing, ever conscious, ever new, and omnipresent joy. The soul is the individualized reflection of ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy, confined within the body of each and every being. Souls, he says, are the radiating rays of spirit, individualized as formless, vibrationless atoms and tissues of spirit. Hence, they coexist with spirit and are of the same essence, just as the sun and its rays are one. But there is a difference. And he gives this analogy. So the moon is reflected in a cup containing water. The cup breaks and the water runs out. Where does the reflection of the moon go? The reflection of the moon may be said to have returned to its inseparable identity in the moon itself. If another cup of water is placed under the moon, however, another reflection of the moon would be reincarnated. So it's a bit confusing to get your head around, but he says the soul is reflected in the bodily cup filled with the water of the mind, and within it we see the moon soul. Okay. So, basically I try and think of it. So there's this cup and it's got water in and it's reflecting the moon, and then it breaks. That would be us dying. And then that reflection of the moon just comes into another cup of water, and that's like our soul. But the moon itself is obviously spirit. Okay. He also talks about how masters, the ones able upon death to sort of come back from the death to become living again. Obviously, that doesn't happen for us, so we just go on and reincarnate. But he points out, where is that? Okay. That, so he says, obviously, look at Jesus as an example, and Kabir. So Kabir was a great 16th century saint whose large following included Hindus and Muslims. And at the time of his death, the disciples quarreled over the manner of conducting his funeral ceremony. And the exasperated master came back from the dead and woke up to give his instructions. And he said, half of my remains should be buried with Muslim rites, and let the other half be cremated with a Hindu sacrament. And then he vanished and was gone. And when the disciples removed the shroud that covered his body, nothing was found but a beautiful array of flowers. Half of these were obediently buried in Megar by the Muslims, who revere his shrine to this day, and the other half was cremated with Hindu ceremonies in Banaras, which I think is just lovely. So that's for the masters. For us, we come back. Okay. So as I mentioned, we sort of have this path of it sort of makes us start to question what is beyond and what is the essence of the soul and what is it that we're taking on to our next life, and why is it that we're taking on things, and what is it, if I could just experience my oneness, what's stopping that? It starts to open all that up. And then, as I mentioned, it starts to sort of think about what's even beyond that. And in chapter two, so again, early on, it talks about what is this thing that is beyond? What is this oneness? And it says, what is not has never been, and what is always is. The truth about the real and the unreal has been realized by the seers. Know that all this vast universe is pervaded by that which is indestructible. No one can destroy what is everlasting and imperishable. The indwelling one is eternal, indestructible and immeasurable, and the bodies of the indwelling one are impermanent. So the body is impermanent, and yet the one that dwells within it is eternal, indestructible, and immeasurable. So the other thing I like to think about when we're talking about reincarnation and why we'd even consider it or contemplate it is that I really feel like it serves as an encouragement for our path. So in chapter 4 and sloka 9 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, when people die who truly know me, instead of taking another birth, they come directly to me. So if we gain enough wisdom, if we awaken in our lifetime, then our cycle of birth and death is over, and we will no longer have another birth. So it's sort of an encouragement on our path when we start to think, okay, I don't want to be reincarnated, even if I don't know what that is. But there's this promise that if before I die I truly have awakened, then that's not going to happen. And the Gita says, as I mentioned before, that all your progress is good. So, we haven't found this chapter, chapter 37. Sorry, I'm sort of flitting around a bit tonight. As I mentioned, reincarnation is kind of dotted throughout the whole Gita. So Arjuna asks, and it's a very sensible question, Krishna, what happens to someone who has sincere belief but can't control the mind yet, or someone who falls away from these practices before they achieve this perfection through yoga? So basically, what if I'm doing all the spiritual practice and yet I die and don't achieve the end goal? Like, what happens to me in this path of reincarnation? And he goes on, has he fallen from this world and the world to come? Does he perish like a cloud dissolved by wind? Does he find himself without support and deluded on his quest for God? And it's like a question that I'm sure comes to us all. Like, what if we don't succeed in this lifetime? What happens? And so this is why I find reincarnation very encouraging to us as a spiritual seeker, because it says, no, it's all worth it, because you come back again. You come back again. And Arjuna begs Krishna here, please, only you can destroy my doubts. And Krishna says, don't worry. There is no destruction in this world or the next for anyone who has embarked on the yogic path. Know for certain that anyone who does good never comes to a bad end. Whoever embarks on the yogic path and leaves his body before reaching the highest goal attains heavenly states with the virtuous. And there he stays a long time and takes birth again in this world in a home of the pure and prosperous in order to continue his quest. So we'll be born again if we've been good spiritual seekers in this lifetime, or have sort of achieved certain steps along our path in terms of wisdom and awakening. We'll be born into a family that is more supportive so that we can progress further on our path. He could be born, or she could be born, into a family of wise yogis, says Krishna, and such a birth is very rare. And it's actually called yoga brashta, and that's when you're born into a spiritual home. So I don't know about you, but I was born into a family of atheists who weren't supportive at all of a spiritual path, and still aren't. But a yoga brashta, if you were a yoga brashta, you'd probably be born, the minute you're born, your parents would be meditating as you're born, and you look over and your father's doing some yoga postures, or maybe they're chanting as you come in, so that you just slip straight back into your path and continue your progression. And in this environment, Krishna says, you'll soon recall the knowledge gained in former births, and you'll strive for realization even more earnestly than before. So I really feel like reincarnation as a concept, as I say, is incredibly encouraging, and almost offers some urgency as well. Not urgency in the way that I mentioned earlier about that some of my Buddhist friends say, of like, oh my God, if you're not enlightened in this life, you could be a beetle in the next, and then you won't have another chance. Because according to the Buddhists, you can only become enlightened if you have a human form. So not that sense of urgency. However, it does, the Gita does make clear that you really don't know when your time is up. You don't know what your karma is, that you could be gone tomorrow. So to ensure that in your next life you maybe become a yoga brashta, or are born into a very supportive spiritual life to help you with your progression. Today is the day that you practice. It's always today. Swami Sachidananda says here, you won't know when the end is coming. It doesn't give you notice. When you're a tenant, at least the landlord gives you a quit notice a month ahead. Otherwise, you can take him to court. But this landlord, the one above, never gives you any notice. He simply says, time to go. And actually, he doesn't always tell you that. The doctor might say, her heart failed. Those are the doctor's words. But the landlord simply took away the key without you even knowing. And any minute, he may ask you to get out. You can't say, no, let me do some more practice before I quit. Because the other day, the Swami said I had to do more. So always be prepared. So the Gita is very practical. And the whole book is really based on what can we do to avoid this cycle of reincarnation and the suffering. How do we get out? And it's really the solved in the path of yoga, this 8-step path. And so it's things like, as we talked about, Jnana Yoga, the practice of Bhakti Yoga, the practice of devotion, and the practice of Karma Yoga, which is service and always offering everything we do to God. And there can be confusion because often, you know, we really don't know this is happening. We don't know how our karma is playing out. So it sort of can be confusing in our lives as we're thinking about the things we can do, about what exactly we can do and what are the good things we should be doing. So I'm just going to tell, so there are some many things that, as I say, the Gita tells us to do, but the main one, and it sort of goes back to what we would get intuitively and what our inner wisdom would tell us as we're starting to think about reincarnation, and that is, okay, well, why would a soul keep coming back? And as we talked about, maybe that's based on desires. So logically, we could say, how do I stop my desires so that my soul will stop needing to come back? And how we stop our desires in yoga is to stop our attachments. So to let go of attachments. And how do we let go of attachments? It is by stilling the mind. It is by devoting our heart instead. It is by serving as much as we can. And just moving within more and more and beginning to move out, move away from being drawn. Our senses are really starting to control the mind. That's really the whole sort of basis of yoga, is letting go of these thoughts and these desires. So that is really how we get out. And it's about becoming dispassionate. Stop wanting and not wanting, exactly, Jim. So even, you know, wanting to become enlightened is still a desire. And it's incredibly sort of, it offers a lot of relief when you start to really think about it, about what you have to do in order, if you want to let go and not have this cycle of reincarnation. You can sort of think, you know, well, you know, I can just let myself be an instrument of Dharma. I can just maybe let myself be guided and moved. I can sort of give up my desires and just see what happens and see how I moved along with it all and stop controlling everything. And that's what really is called like net karma, when we're trying to net out karma. So at the beginning, when we make a consecration and we're saying we don't want the karmic fruits, really we don't want the good karma, because the good karma means coming back. The good karma means there's a desire there for us, that we want a nice life. So it's no good saying I'm going to do some good deeds and in my next life I'll come back a rich person, because there's obviously a desire to be a rich person that's going to make you come back the next life and the next until you become a millionaire. So we don't want that. We actually don't even want the good karma. It's letting go of all the desires. And what is lovely about that, it's, and I was thinking about you, Jim, with this, as you were talking, you mentioned the other week about sort of seeing everything as perfect, yeah, or the letting it be. That's really all you need to do. So to be free from desire, you just have to not want anything to be different. Just sort of seeing everything as it is and allowing what needs to happen. And so one of the things I love about even just thinking about reincarnation and karma is that I think, well, my karma was such that in this lifetime I needed to be born in the certain family I'm in, and I needed to be surrounded with the people I'm with, and I needed to have all the experiences that I'm having. So if I trip over my shoelaces and fall flat on my face, I needed that experience. So there's nothing to get angry about. Every experience is karma, and that karma is being unloaded. So it's sort of a beautiful way, then, a very relaxing way to look at the world. Of just everything is perfectly unfolding as it is, as long as I don't get sucked in and attached to whatever's happening from a perspective of, as Jim says, wanting or not wanting. So it's actually sort of, as I say, when you start to think about reincarnation and karma, it can be like a big weight off your shoulders, and, you know, rather than something heady or weird, you can just think, well, everything is just fine. Everything is just folding as it should be. It's just this predetermined karmic passage. So everything that happens to you, you know, so who you marry, whether you have children, all those experiences, they're all just part and parcel of this beautiful karmic passage. And then you can start to see the beauty in everything. Because whatever your desires were, they're being fulfilled in this lifetime so that you don't have to have them repeated. You're always making progress. Okay. So Ram Dass points out, stop creating waves, don't be so attached, and act out of your pure Dharma, and becoming an instrument of Dharma. So Dharma, in the sense, I just wanted to point this out, Dharma in the Buddhist sense is the teachings of Buddhism and religion. It's about the teachings. Dharma in the Hindu sense is following cosmic order, just allowing whatever's supposed to happen, allowing everything to move through you, becoming guided and moved. So for Arjuna, what's happening at the back of Kurukshetra on the field, really Krishna's saying to him, you know, you put away all these thoughts you're having, you know, it's all nonsense anyway, because there's this cycle of reincarnation. Even beyond that, there's Brahma, and there's this absolute oneness that we all are part of, the spirit. So just let yourself be moved. This is going to happen, this battle, whether you like it or not. So just let the Dharma move you. Which is interesting, because when you start to think about free will, how much of it is free will that we live, and how much is Dharma? And obviously we feel like we're making choices, but are we really making choices? It's sort of an interesting way to look at it. And Ram Dass shares this story about how he looks at it. So he says he was back in India and had gone looking for Maharaji, but he was nowhere to be found. No one knew where he was. So he joined up with some other Westerners at a meditation retreat in Bodh Gaya. That's where Buddha got enlightened. As he figured, if it worked for Buddha, maybe it would work for him. And after a couple of weeks of meditating, he felt like he was ready to resume his search for Maharaji. And one of the women in his group had come to India overland in a big Mercedes bus with a driver, and she offered them the bus, this group of Westerners, to take them to Delhi, where they could celebrate Shivaratri and then go looking for Maharaji again. So 35 of them, 34 meditators and the bus driver, all set out for Delhi. And after weeks in this meditation retreat, they're all really looking forward to hotels with beds and hot water and restaurant meals and ice cream cones. And the road to Delhi took them very near the city of Allahabad, which is where once every 12 years there's this huge celebration called the Kumbh Mela. And millions of people come there at this astrologically ideal moment to bathe in this confluence of three sacred rivers. And it's the largest spiritual gathering held anywhere in the world. So the Mela had just taken place a few weeks before this bus trip, and one of the people on the bus who'd been at the Mela said they should make a detour and go and look at the Mela grounds. So Ram Dass says that, you know, it seemed a very reasonable thing to do. They were all supposed to be practicing yogis, and it was a very sacred site, and off they should go. But then it would have added another 2 hours to their journey, and they were all really dying to get to a hotel and just, you know, eat some good food. So they were going back and forth, and finally everyone agreed that Ram Dass, who's the oldest person there, has to make this decision. And so he's like going back and forth in his head. And finally, you know, just as they're about to pass the turn off to Allahabad, he says, okay, turn right. And they drive to Allahabad and they pull into this empty mela grounds. There's just like a handful of people walking around. And the fellow who had been to the mela sort of told the bus driver to head to a little Hanuman temple that he remembered visiting. And as they parked next to the temple, someone looking out the bus window shouted out, oh my God, there's Maharaji. And there he was, says Ram Dass, walking along through the mela grounds. So they all pulled out of the bus crying and, you know, pranaming and touching Maharaji's feet and saying they couldn't find him and they've gone in search of him, and it was just this beautiful experience that they led to him. And he says that Maharaji looked completely unconcerned with the whole thing and just said, come on, follow us. And off he went in a rickshaw, and the bus began to follow them through the streets of Allahabad. And when they arrived at the house of one of Maharaji's devotees who was next to him in the rickshaw, the wife came rushing out and said, come in, come in, dinner's always ready for you. We've been cooking all day. Maharaji woke us up at 6 this morning and said, please start cooking because there are going to be 35 people here for dinner tonight. So it's just such a lovely story. And Ram Dass says, so who do you suppose it was who thought he was sitting on the bus deciding whether to visit the mela grounds? Long before Ram Dass even made the decision for the group to turn off, Maharaji was already decided. So Maharaji knew about it that morning. Ram Dass just played his part. He just thinks he decided to go to the mela grounds, but really his decision was inevitable. So I love this because I think that all of us can relate. There are times in our lives where we've made decisions where we can really look at it and see that maybe that decision was given to us. Whether that was in the collective conscious, that's kind of how we approach it from a Western standpoint, that it was sort of, we were able to access it and it came through us, or whether it was part of our karma coming through, as maybe Hindus would say, or the yogis would say, or the grace sometimes that comes through. So I just also think, you know, I don't have a strong personal view about free will and determinism. but I think it's sort of a fascinating thing to think about the two together, that we have perhaps this free will to sit down and study, although Ram Dass says, you know, do you think it was coincidence that you're sat here listening to the Bhagavad Gita? Don't you think that was your karma? You know, isn't it just so random? And I'm sure we all experience these very random things that happen in life that we think, surely it was just like part of some process that I got here. Okay. So just to finish off, I was just going to read a bit from Ram Dass's, just to end up. Okay, so gradually, it says, as we think about reincarnation and karma, it begins to dawn on us that we are merely part of a process. So think about that. You and I are nothing more than process. I am process of continuing mind moments, each one separate from the others. There is no permanent me being incarnated and reincarnated. There's merely the law of cause and effect. So, yeah, so we might think of it as a soul and we sort of give it this personality perhaps even, but actually it's just this group of thoughts that have been these samskaras and waves that have been created by actions and thoughts, and then those incarnate into a body that then gives rise to more actions and more thoughts, and so it goes on and on. It's just a process. There's no person in it. There's no me in it. It's just this passing parade, he says, of the laws of nature, the laws of an unfolding illusion of manifestation. And the more we open to that kind of perspective, the more dispassionate we can become in just watching it all unfold. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, you see that every melodrama, even the wonderful melodrama of I'm trying to get enlightened, it just creates more karma, and you can't afford that. You just don't want that anymore. There is really no stance that you can hold on to and still go through the door. You have to let go of everything. And that's why Krishna says at the beginning to Arjuna, you know, let go of these models you have about your relatives and what's right and what's wrong, because he's also sat there on the the battlefield saying, oh, wouldn't it just be terrible if we killed all these people and wouldn't we go to hell? And let go of all that and just allow yourself to be moved. Just let the laws of karma unfold as it's supposed to, play out the role that's been assigned to you. Because when you do that, you've surrendered to your dharma. And so you're no longer desiring anything. So you're living in a world of no karma. You're not creating any more karma. And so you may, you know, Buddha lived another 40 years after he was enlightened. So you may still be here having to live out your life. But ideally, you're trying to, and still letting your karma move through you, but you're not creating more. So again and again, says Ram Dass, the Gita turns our perspective upside down, just as it does here for Arjuna. It shifts our sense of what our lives are about. So as we begin to adopt the Gita's perspective as our own, we'll notice that our own focus starts to change. And instead of always preoccupying ourselves with trying to get what we think we want or need, we'll just start to get quiet and start to go inside and to listen and to ask, how can we serve? How can I just be part of the cosmic order? How can I be part of the Tao? How can I just let it flow through me? And we just wait for this inner prompting. So we try and hear, he says, rather than decide what it is we should do next. And as we listen, we'll hear our dharma more and more clearly. And so we'll begin tuning more and more of our acts to that place of deeper wisdom. And obviously, as our acts come from a place that's very pure, that isn't creating a sort of this adding to this cycle. And as that happens, says Ram Dass, all of our fascination with our roles and our plans and our desires and our melodramas just begin to fall away. And more we just open ourselves up to being this instrument of the Dharma. And then he says we discover that we've lost our lives, but really we've found them. So a lot there in reincarnation, I say it can get quite heady. And again, it's within this crystal ball. It's still part of the illusion. It's not the truth of who we are. But it's very helpful as a tool to encourage us on our journey, to encourage us to sort of not have to come back and suffer. So why take the risk if you're just a logical person? But also just to encourage us to accept where we are so beautifully and just say, you know, whatever happened, you know, this is where I am. And when good things happen to us, we can say, wow, then that's wonderful. And thank you for the part that led to this. Let me do more of that so that I can sort of allow things to move through me, not to have sort of, you know, not out of desire, but just as sort of a place of gratitude for all the good things that happen and just resting in gratitude, and that's it. And then all the other things, sort of seeing them as a rolling out of karma so we don't have to come back again. So that is all from me this evening on reincarnation. I've got a couple of minutes. I don't know if anyone wants to share anything or has any questions at all. No. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I hope you all have a lovely week. I'm looking forward to coming back next week. I'm not quite sure what we're going to talk about. I think we're going to be talking about Brahman and God. So not much, nothing too big. But yeah, I hope you have a lovely week and blessings to you all. Namaste. Thanks. I'm going to pass it back over, ready for Carolyn. Thank you.